joining us this morning. Different day, same gal, Jana Valakovic. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hopefully, she has such perkiness
faking
compared
it
to the rundown Tuesday version we normally get.
Right, just faking it, that's all.
Yeah. All right, you wanted to, first thing you have to do is you got to put the date, you got to write down the date.
I will do this. So I have been wondering for listeners out there why Brian gets to ask all the questions. So I grabbed the book and the Ever Wonder Why, and I want to ask Brian, why is it bad luck to walk under a ladder?
I would suspect that in days of yore, whether it was the buckets flying out of the second floor in England that had, what were they called, chamber pots?
Mm-hmm.
Coming out. I know that's why gals are always walking on the inside, are supposed to walk on the inside, and the guys towards the street,
mm-hmm,
if they were going to get hit. But it probably had something to do with like paint or materials falling on people.
Nope.
Oh, well.
Not even close.
How about chamber pots? Was
nope.
that close?
Nope.
That was just kind of the theme of what my answer was.
I know. So the ladder leaning against the wall forms a triangle.
Yeah.
The symbol of the Trinity and the mystic number 3. It was once believed that to walk through the triangle would be to defy the Trinity and become susceptible to the devil's ploys.
Ah. Okay.
There you go.
A triangle.
I know. We're going to have to ponder that for a little while, aren't we?
Well, most ladders today have got the legs at the other side. So if you try to walk through, you probably clock yourself instead of being able to slide in underneath.
Yeah, think about that. Devil's ploy.
I got the Trinity part.
Yeah, there you go.
Geez. So what's been, you've been busy with all these fires and stuff? This thing over at the state line, a million acres plus now?
The Dixie Fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I had a really interesting experience this week. Followed up from August, I was invited down to Ukiah to spend some time with the Mendocino Fire Safe Council, and they have a neat program where they help the elderly and the disabled with doing something called home assessments and kind of defensible space evaluations. And they asked me to come down and help lead one of those for a gentleman who was 90 and pretty close to the shores of Lake Mendocino.
Ooh.
So... and they decided to make a media event out of the whole thing and brought the State Fire Safe Council over, and we did...
So we are in the presence of a media celebrity?
Well, of course.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, we had a whole gaggle of people there from various agencies, and, 90 doesn't look great. I think please take me to the woodshed before I get to 90. And, what you can maintain and how you take care of all the things you have and how you just deal with basic functions. And so was there someone in need? Absolutely. And the interesting piece is that the Fire Safe Council then partnered with the Hopland Band of the Pomo Indians, and they have a fuels crew, and they immediately did a bunch of fuels reduction work. And they also had a little bit of stuff to do with helping improve some of the condition of the structure.
So they helped out this one fella,
right? And
with this situation,
and they've been doing this for other folks, but they wanted to make it more of a learning opportunity and create some ability for other people to understand what we were doing. What should happen recently? The Hopkins fire.
His house caught on fire.
His house is gone.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, 40 homes or something to that effect, arson, and the Hopkins fire that broke out just, 10 or so
days
ago.
That's the thing that I don't, I just, arson.
Well.
I just can't connect how anybody would do that. If you like to light a fire in your fireplace, that's cool, but arson is a whole different situation.
I mean, there's not enough information to say what exactly happened yet. They just have arrested an individual, called it arson. But the proximity between trying to help this guy, which the work was not fully complete, and how fast the situation changed for him. The great news is that there was enough warning and they were able to evacuate him, which was not simple, I would expect. But it just all brings it so, it's so personal real now. And it's personal and, yeah. and it's hard, you know, it's hard. I mean, I knew that house had challenges and I can talk about some of those if you're interested in it, but
the design or how it was maintained,
how it was maintained, primary issue, but then, you know, so it's a home that, scraped on a bit of a overlook, beautiful look of the lake, just a, you know, like a landing, so to speak, in forestry terms, right? So down a long, windy road. The issue was that the house wasn't big enough, so the house expanded into the garage. As so many folks do, they convert the garage. Well, then what happens? What do you do with your stuff, right? You have a sudden need for sheds and other buildings. And as we all know, the longer we live in a place, the more likely we are to accumulate a few extra things. And so we had one really rinky-dink shed that I was able to squeeze between it and the window of the main house.
It wasn't the 6 foot.
No, there was no separation really between the shed and the house. And then there was a interesting kind of caged in area where he stored a lot of things that looked like it might have been a little aviary. So it had pony walls and then a nice roof and then screening.
Like a gazebo kind of thing.
Kind of gazebo-ish, but it was too small to sit there and be out of the mosquitoes. And it just had that, it didn't look like a chicken coop either. And that was right next to the house. So there were two fundamental buildings that were just filled with things that couldn't prevent flame or ember entry into either of those. So embers, you know, burning bits of material that move in front of the fire column.
Flying ash.
Yeah. But then the other thing that was interesting is that clearly the gentleman required regular electricity and so for his medical conditions. And so he had this cobbed together system with a propane system for hot water, a backup generator for electricity, and I don't know if it was the family that did it or if it was an electrician and other folks that patched it together, but it left a whole lot of vulnerability in
like
that.
Like open wires?
Open wires, open holes into the roof, open cavities into the walls. I mean, you can imagine that at a certain age, you just hope to have something to be able to give you electricity, and it doesn't really matter what it takes to get there.
So he was off the grid.
No, he had the capacity to produce his own electricity if needed.
Right, but he wasn't connected in?
No, he was regularly connected.
Oh, so he had both.
It was backup.
Oh.
His backup system.
Well, that shows a little bit more forethought.
Absolutely.
KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbara Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Yana Valakovic. So in the last segment, we were talking about this situation, which is kind of cool, having the community educational component being in there, but then the reality of fire and some of the challenges associated with that. Yeah, that area around Clear Lake and
it's Lake Calpella and Lake Mendocino.
Has been torched, what, 3-4 times in the last 15, 20 years?
Probably. I don't know the fire history. It's
a lot of grass.
No, it was mostly shrubs and chaparral.
And then you get growing up into that. Great stuff if you're a fan of wildfire.
Yeah, I mean, and a beautiful place to live. I mean, you know, had a great view of the lake, and no, I mean, really a nice view of the lake.
If you're an ocean guy, lakes are kind of like a wannabe.
Well,
yeah.
Well, if you live in Ukiah, anything that looks like water is probably a good thing.
Fair enough. Point taken.
I mean, I think the thing that really struck me is how do we help our most vulnerable? And, you know, we see them on our streets. We see them in our neighborhoods. We know them in our family. And, you know, and it was a series of interesting decisions and that led to his home being in the condition that it was in. And not easy things to fix overnight. And, you know, when I got there, the first thing people asked me is, well, what should we be doing? I said, working on an evacuation plan because, you know, the amount of challenge in this particular structure, in this particular location means early evacuation and alerts are really critical. So hence his backup battery system and, or power system. And
well, particularly if somebody had to go in to get him and then come back out, if this was a frail 90.
He was a very frail 90, yes.
He's not going to be driving, you know, jumping out in his motorcycle and driving off, right?
I hope not.
Yeah, okay.
With a cape.
Yeah. See, I'm ready for the Monday morning start, too.
No. But, you know, what is it that we can do to, you know, within our organizations, within our communities, within our ways that we organize ourselves, whether they're through our church groups or what they are, to help people to understand these fundamental issues in creating fire adaptation into our, you know, our mindsets as well as the structures and the environment that we live in.
Typically, do we think about those worst-case scenarios? I suspect not. I mean, particularly if you are in a more developed area.
I think that's the challenge to realize that, you know, people ask me, are there safe zones in California? And I'm like, well, you know, maybe King Salmon from a fire perspective, you know, not from a tsunami perspective, perhaps, or, you know, something from that degree. I mean, I think all of California is capable of burning under the right conditions. And the challenge for those of us that live closer to the wetter climates is that when we're in condition to burn, so is the rest of the state.
Yeah,
and
everybody so else is there already.
And
yeah.
Resources are deployed to handle the rest of the state, and then we're left on our own.
That's probably the biggest thing that we don't think about. It's not the burning part, but folks in other areas are already dealing with this stuff. The thing out in Susanville,
yeah.
Holy cow. You know, everybody's over there, so if we have a little dust up here, handle it, guys. You know, we're not pulling off here to take care of this little thing.
Well, I mean, with a knob fire, yeah, resources were redeployed very quickly because it was closer to a more human establishment. It's a lot more people, right? You know, people and lives come
first. But
that
was Forest Service, wasn't it?
That was Forest Service. It still happens. Yeah. It's in the same system, but.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you get the various jurisdictional challenges. Sean was on, Robertson. He said, I didn't even get a call.
Then. Interesting.
It was Forest Service, and they had their stuff, and they took care of it. It's like, okay, that's interesting. But we look at Southern Humboldt, let's say Tinderbox, and leave it at that.
Right.
You know, let alone we get down into Mendocino.
I mean, what Southern Humboldt has as an advantage, though, is a pretty vast network of volunteer fire departments, and they are really good at that early attack, though. I mean, because we have a lot of people in a lot of places.
Blocksburg, Alder Point Road, something last week?
Yeah, there was one in Garberville.
Yeah. It's like, jump on it. It's neat, I think, because they're more of a homogenous community. Everybody kind of gets it.
Well, I think being rural means being rural.
Yeah.
There's still a rural identity that is independent of politics, I think. I mean, when there's a light. Well, no, I'm just saying that when there's a lightning ignition, I don't think it matters whether you're coming from.
No, but like here, if it happened in the middle of downtown Eureka.
Sure.
Okay, most people are probably going to be looking at the fire department to respond to it, not to step up themselves to help out.
Clearly.
That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Yeah.
It was not a political comment about the recall. Knock it off.
You're so terrible.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So with these fires, are we getting better at the preventative actions to take in advance? Or is it just, okay, yeah, I know about it, but I'm still going to have that pine tree next to the house?
Well, let me flip the question around to you. I know that you've had a family cabin in a rural setting. Do you feel like your family knowledge has changed in this conversation, or?
You sold it a month and a half ago.
Well, you took action, right?
But I was concerned. I was hoping that it didn't, because I was hoping that the folks that bought the place would be able to enjoy it. That's what my thought was. I mean, there was enough activity going on and the smoke for weeks, and it was no surprise. It wasn't like a fire strike a mile and a half away with a little bit of wind and here it comes roaring. That's a different dynamic. But yeah, it's one of the risks taken to be in those areas. I mean, we had the first cabin did burn. Yeah. Somebody breaking in. Dad had the rule, if it starts, let it go. Hmm. Just don't let it spread. You know, that was it. And, you know, unfortunately, that was the experience we had. You can't do that with the neighborhood. You can't do that with the town. But as an individual property owner, that's an option that's always out there. Does this ball mean it's time for the break? I think it does. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with UC Cooperative Extension.
What is it?
Advisor. I'll just go with advisor. Yana Valakovic.
Doesn't mean anybody listens.
No. It's not like it's a paid consultation.
No, you get what you pay for.
Yes, exactly. Every morning right here at this time. Last time we got together, it was the Drought Task Force, Kumbaya,
right?
Nuts and granola crowd that you were going to be meeting with the supervisors and kind of see what might happen. And there was conversation, a little bit of discussion. Any action taken?
Yeah, there are a couple of pieces of action. There's been more effort to try and understand the needs of organized water suppliers. I'll call them community service districts for shorthand, but they're not all CSDs, to try and figure out what their needs are in storage and in other kind of infrastructure pieces that could be helpful around drought. And Hank Seaman from the Department of Public Works is helping facilitate conversation around grant applications and other resources that might be able to be brought down to assist those folks in.
How much is needed? I mean, I'm thinking of Eureka. We got the two water tanks out by the zoo. You got the high rise, and you got the MAD. Okay, I mean, if you had to store a week's worth of water for the city of Eureka or for HCSD. Well, how big would you need?
Well, we store our water in Eureka in Ruth Lake.
Right.
But what about the town of Miranda? What about Orleans? What about Willow Creek?
Rio Dell.
Scotia. Redway. Yeah. You know, those are all communities that are in different situations. So Shelter Cove, for example.
Can't use the ocean.
Desalinization, yeah, it's an interesting topic. It takes a lot of electricity.
Well, and time, too.
And time. Yeah. So trying to understand where they're matching their needs to their supplies. I know there's one community that's wishing to expand. There's folks that want to come into their district. So how to match the supply to that future expansion. And it's maybe because the folks that are on individual systems are having reliability problems. So it would be more reliable to join the bigger system. So, you know, trying to figure out how to take care of the range of needs and make sure that we have what it takes. So if you recall from 2013-14, Rio Dell, Shell has junior water rights and not senior water rights. And so
that means they're number two on the
They're number two. Yeah. And so they work to develop some alternate pumping sites and other locations to and storage since then. So things like that are possible for us in this space. And hopefully there'll be some state resources to help water suppliers.
When Michelle, I talked with her a couple months ago. She was talking about the water storage tanks in her district in Southern Humboldt. Some of the challenges associated with that, and some of the benefits of that. Are storage tanks for water the way to salvation for a lot of the rural individual? I mean, say the five acre parcel folks, can they do that as a backup? And is that enough, or it seems like it's more fundamental than that.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think, you know, I have rural property, and I really don't know how much water we use. In a calendar year, I don't really know.
Who tracks it?
Who tracks it? Yeah. So, you know, giving technical resources to help people figure out what their true water demands are and whether there's conservation opportunities. So when you've got a dry year, you know what your base level is to make sure you have what you need. And so you can store water, you know, during the wet time that can carry you forward to the, you know, the prolonged difficult period. I mean, the interesting part right now is that the days are getting shorter. And so the vegetation and photosynthesis begins to decline. And so we should start to see our springs come up a little bit because the trees aren't sucking as much water.
You mean in basic, we need sunlight for chlorophyll?
Well, yeah.
See, I remember something from third grade. And an avocado can grow tall.
Right? But, you know.
I mean, it makes sense. And I would think, you know, logically, okay, we're going to have a couple storage tanks. We're going to gather water during the wintertime when it's raining. We'll be set as long as we don't drink it and taste it all, you know, funny plasticky. So, we're okay
Let's look at Matole. The Upper Matole's done some really interesting things where they've helped. There's a lot of small lots right along the Matole River, and they had riparian water rights to the Matole. And, you know, the Matole's had a lot of energy put into fish restoration and, you know, all that stuff. Well, so the Sanctuary Forest, the organization that works in the Upper Matole primarily, they helped develop a program which helped landowners figure out what their water demands were and then help them, through some assistance programs, store enough water to meet that demand. And then when the river conditions get so low, they have a commitment towards forbearance and they'll only work off their stored water. So
as a community?
As a community, individual landowner. So they're, I believe it's a deed restriction, but they got a rebate program or got grant funds that supported the additional water storage that they would need so that when the river conditions got so critically dire that everyone stops pulling
they
from the river.
They were pulling out of it, yeah.
Right.
Now, do they have the pot farmers on board? Because that is
illegals. It's a voluntary program. I don't think they look at legal or non-legal. This has predated a lot of this effort in Humboldt County. So they've been doing this for, I would say, 10 or more years.
But in the last couple of years, I know that you know, with the legalization, there's that the permitting and who gets how much from where with water.
Well,
our
permitting structure right now, it addresses that if you are on springs, there's a forbearance program that comes when it gets when resources are critically low, and a little bit different than a well system. So there's a kind of a different tiered system or a different strategy for the water source.
Well, I would think if you have a well on your property, it's pretty much your water, right? Or is it like oil?
I think it's a little more complicated than that. I'm not a water rights person in this space, and especially when we're dealing with cannabis and the regulations that the county can develop, it's a little more nuanced than that. John Ford would be your person to talk to about that.
Bring him in next time. KINS, News and Information Time. I warn him, too. I get to ask the questions.
No, I get to ask. Ever wonder why?
Hey, folks. Flying local is buying local. And with three airlines serving five destinations, Humboldt County has more choices than ever. Fly on American, Avelo, or United Airlines. We have service to Denver, Hollywood Burbank, LAX, Phoenix, and San Francisco airports. Now's the time to book and save on that getaway. Or have friends and family fly to visit the beautiful Redwood Coast. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org. Fly Humboldt, more flights to more destinations.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:46. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Velikovic. Jana, the challenges with drought, I think, are multiplied because it's a logical issue, but it's also an emotional issue. So you got both sides of the brain. You got all camps all weighing in. We haven't talked about fish.
Sure.
And we haven't talked about Native American rights and all that level of discussion also, since we're talking about Southern Humboldt and Northern Mendocino. But those components are in there also. It doesn't sound like it's a simple, easy, other than we hope that Troy is right with his weather forecast. It's going to be wet, and then we don't have this discussion, and we push it down the road for 4 or 5 years. Is there burgeoning law in water? I would suspect that there almost has to be.
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer that question. I think what's interesting about California is that we have riparian rights. So water rights originally started in California around riparian rights, meaning that you have rights to water if you're adjacent to it. And then came a system of appropriative water rights. So Mono Lake and LA is an example where LA has appropriated water outside of the district and is able to pull it in. My understanding, which is very limited in the water rights realm, is that most states started with riparian rights, moved over to appropriative rights, and got rid of their riparian rights. And California has a matrix of both. And so you've got historic rights, you've got appropriative rights, and so, you know,
a train wreck is what you're saying.
Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, right?
Yeah.
So it's complicated in California. And, you know, then we get this, you know, this politicalization around what's the future climate going to be and what's the future rainfall and precipitation going to be. And I think it's a shared resource. We're all in this together. And, you know, we all have basic human needs. The environment has basic needs. And so we just have to figure it out.
Tree damage.
Yeah.
At what point does it, or plants, yeah. does it, we will speak for the rhododendron crowd also. At what point does the water, the drought, start to damage the tree or plant or make it more susceptible? Is there just kind of a rule of thumb?
No, there's no rule of thumb. It's not simple to say, but, you know, my crystal ball says that we're going to have a lot of residual damage to forests all across California as a result of this drought.
So we get a great wet, soggy, drippy winter. They don't come springing back.
Well, when you get trees that are stressed, then they have less available resources to be able to fight off attack from beetles or to manage pathogens that may be working on them. And so there's some weird synergies between the amount of precipitation, the temperature, and the timing that creates some forest health challenges. I mean, we all know that we need a little less density in our forests, that there's too many straws pulling from the same pot. So, you know, something that helps reduce, you know, the amount of trees we have is generally not a bad thing, but we just don't want the whole forest to die all at once.
Now, you're not saying clear cut there in code speak, are you?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I think we've gotten accustomed to thinking that a lot of trees is a really good thing, and it's just too many straws.
See, I can get you in trouble, too. You take my question away, I'm just going to come after you.
You are such a...
So if a tree is vulnerable,
sure,
or in a more vulnerable state, does that necessarily mean that it's lights out and it's going to come down or get infected? Or does that just mean that every year that it's in that situation, it's more and more likely that it's going to not be as healthy as it could have been?
Well, in the coastal counties that we work in, mostly we're talking about forest diseases. And so trees pick up, they have less resources, they pick up more issues that nag at them for a longer time. Some trees are better able to...
Not fatal necessarily?
Not necessarily fatal, but, okay. You know, you can have a whole bunch of chronic long-term issues just like people as we get older. Right?
Keep going back to that age thing.
But it also can create a cascading effect where on an insect-related issue, you can have natural bark beetles, native bark beetles come in, and there's just not enough resources to defend.
Kind of start getting a domino through the forest,
right,
then.
And ward off that kind of attack.
Is there anything you can do other than, once a tree gets in that situation, other than cut it down and get it out of there?
Thinning, density management. Yeah. Good silvicultural practice, that all comes into play. Rain dance.
Now, I didn't even use a flashcard on that one. If you have an issue, you know who to call.
You get what you pay for.
I would have used it, but I didn't think of it. So with the long term, if we do get a La Nina coming through, that doesn't necessarily replenish everything and bring it back, and the aquifers are now all flowing and full, and it still takes a while, right?
It takes a while.
Yeah.
It depends on the quality, the timing of precipitation, whether we get long saturating rains or...
Or runoff.
Or big flashy events, and long saturating rains, you know, are better for forest health, but they also help liquefy our soils around here, right? We know that when we get those...
Slides,
yes.
Does anything grow in blue goo?
Wow, you always have such interesting questions.
I was thinking slides, and then what starts to move.
I mean, if the blue goo is stable for a while, there's some plants that will hang out there until it moves again.
But nothing that'll stabilize it. I mean, the little grasses.
Blue goo is really a super deep physical feature. It's not just a little shallow thing. It's we call it a deep-seated issue. The soil, it's so structurally fundamental to how that hillside is developed that you can't put a little surficial Band-Aid on it and make it fix it.
An azalea won't hold things in place.
Well, you can believe that.
And you believe what you want too, as we head out of here. Thanks for coming by. See everybody tomorrow.